Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the weekly podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C. This week, we woke up to another horrific news from Tajikistan. The latest news was about the court decision in Khujand sentencing Naim John Samiyev, former member of a banned Islamic Revival Party of Tajikistan, for 15 years. Though the latest, but unfortunately, he is one of many opposition activists who are currently in jail, some serving lifetime terms. Among them is Mohammed Ali Haidt, the deputy chairman of the party, whose health condition is reportedly deteriorating. In today's episode, we wanted to discuss what is that Mr. Haidt is going through, what do we know about his health, about his circumstances in jail, and legal conditions surrounding his continued detention. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Steve Severlu, Human Rights Watch's Central Asia researcher, Homeira Bakhtiar, independent Tajik journalist and activist based in Europe, Salim John Ayubov, acting director of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Tajik service, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. Okay, Steve, let's start with you. There's a lot to talk about, Mr. Haidt, but first, let's introduce him to those who's not familiar with him in his case. I guess you know him personally. So please tell us, who's he and why he's in jail?
Well, Mohammed Ali Haidt is a very interesting person that Human Rights Watch has known for many years. He actually got his start as a journalist before entering politics, and in the early years of Tajikistan's independence, worked on some of the more independent publications that became really popular in Tajikistan. He then became part of the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan and became its deputy head. And Mohammed Ali Haidt was known to be the figure that held the political party together on a day-to-day basis. He was the guy you would go to if you really wanted to know what was what and what was going on. But he was also known for other things. I should say he wasn't really a politician. At that time, at Tajikistan's relatively rich civil society, I think he played a very important role as somebody who bridged this divide between the religious aspects of Tajikistan and the civil society and the secular. He was somebody that would brief everybody that came to town, that came to Dushanbe, to tell them about the important issues of religious freedom and freedom of expression. He was really a fountain of information about the crackdown by the authorities on religious believers. There was a campaign that we might remember that began roughly around 2008-2009 when the government began shuttering the doors of hundreds of mosques across Tajikistan. And Mohammed Ali Haidt was somebody that would really help you gain a foothold on what was happening and always was very fair. He was also a fixture at international conferences on human rights. And so when he was arrested in September 2015, it came as a big shock to Human Rights Watch and to all that know him, because he was always someone who was extremely constructive and fair. And while he was part of an opposition political party, he really supported the notion of constructive dialogue and of dialogue in general on human rights issues and religion.
So the reason he was got in was because authorities accused him of being part of this Nazarzoda-related events, right?
That's right. On September 16th, 2015, the government arrested the entire senior leadership of the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan. They had arbitrarily prevented the party from operating a month earlier. And then we saw these very murky events, which had never been proven to be an actual coup. We would say it was an alleged coup by the Defense Minister. And he was arrested with other members of the party, put in jail, and then the party was declared a terrorist organization. He was then convicted to a life sentence in June 2016 with the other members, other 13, 14 members of the party.
Yeah. Okay. Salim John, again, officially, first, congratulations on your new assignment. We wish you good luck, though we are focused on Mr. Haidt's case today, but he's one of many people in similar situations. So you have a tough country to report on. Also, your unit is one of the few open windows on Tajikistan for us to make sense of what's really going on in that country. So truly appreciate it, Salim John.
Thank you so much. I wanted to add something to what Steve shared with all of us. I knew Muhammad Ali very well since the early 1990s,
right,
when he was among those Tajik intellectuals who founded first free societies like Rubaru, like Rastokhiz. He worked with the Tajik radio at the time, and he was one of the prominent radio journalists at the time. I remember that people have been waiting for when he and his colleague Bobo John Shafi will come to air and talk to the people. They founded the first radio program with the participation of dozens of other peoples. It means opened the way for the people to talk freely. During the perestroika and glasnost. And Muhammad Ali was at the beginning a secular politician. However, I think he joined the Islamic Party. Some of his friends were unhappy about it, but I understand him that he was watching that how the secular parties are destroying themselves by internal feud. And also, I think his promotion to the deputy chairman of the party is not a coincidence. It has a deep meaning because he was a kind of a guy who can confront any radical ideas inside of the party. So I have a very good impression of him.
So this nice and just man is in prison in a way that he won't see the sunlight anymore if the way things stands. But also, Salim John, I was reading on your website a report involving an interview with Mr. Haidt's wife, though short information, but there were some horrific details, I should say, that the way Mr. Haidt is treated in jail.
That's right.
Torture, pressure. So what do you know, what is he going through in jail?
I think he was under torture and pressure, and he was beaten up from the very beginning. Why? Because Muhammad Ali is someone who committed to the law and who knew all laws and regulations of the country. And it seems to me that from the very beginning, he was against all those what happened to the party. And maybe he started, as Russians say, or head of the prison say, Kachat Prava. He started to talk to them. He started to explain them what they are doing is against the law and things like this. And there was the first video came out from inside of the prison was the very beginning. And it shows his face, and it showed that he was severely beaten from the very beginning. Today, we are hearing that the new chief of the penitentiary system of Tajikistan is saying that the situation is changing, and he himself personally inspecting all the prisons from different parts of the country. There is no complaints about torture. So probably the situation is a little bit better than, let's say, 1 month or 2 months ago. However, still we know that to make the situation normal, the government, the authorities should change probably 70% of those people who are working in the prisons.
It's truly disturbing even to think in these terms. How old he is, Salim John?
Maybe Humaira knew better than me, but he's 59, maybe 58, 59.
Yeah, definitely not a young person anymore. So Humaira, how's his current state of health? I mean, this was what I had in mind to discuss more when it comes to Mr. Haidt, because we are hearing kind of a horrific news about the deteriorating health of Mr. Haidt. So what do we know about how he is in terms of health-wise these days?
Thank you very much. First, I want to say that he is now 62, something around, because he was born in 1957. So about health, first, I share an information about political prisoners, because some months ago, I was in touch with a very close family member of political prisoners who was released. And this person told to me that how political prisoners are under the hard punishment. It starts with the dirty of rooms and insects. and will finish with some kind of the hardest punishment, like it is when they will get you up and put in very small, cold and white room where you cannot even sleep or sit. And also I talked to another member of one political prisoners who said that they are beating them in the next room or closed room just because they want to get afraid everyone. Yeah. This person told me that it was the hardest years for this political prisoners was 2015 and 2016. Until the end, they beat them every day.
Yeah, horrific details. Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much. So about health.
Yeah. I want just to add that about health, actually, we know already that the Hayit's wife informed everyone that he cannot get his medicine and no one can help him. And even maybe he cannot see them in next 6 months because they are like putting him in pressure every day. The first problem, they cannot eat a good meal because there is not healthy food. Yeah. And usually prisoners are eating the food who is bringing their family. But we know that Islamic Renaissance Party's prisoners, they don't have this opportunity because many of them are sentenced for whole life and many of them is seeing their family just one time in 6 months.
Yeah.
So there is no food, there is no medical helps.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's why I think that Muhammad Ali Hayit has maybe the worst situation right now because, as reminded here, he was a very important and very popular member of the party.
Yeah, so we are getting this information about his health in peace and bits. Please feel free to add anything you know other than what just described by Humaira. Steve, Salim, John, Bruce.
Sure.
I can add one point that on February 6th, he got a heart attack, and however, he didn't receive any medical aid assistance. It was confirmed by a source close to the system who was not ready to give his name, but it's the same Muhammad Ali's spouse told to journalists that. But before that, we know Hayit had been suffering from many other diseases. So if after this heart attack, he didn't receive any medical help, so just imagine, because as we know, this kind of thing demands a lot of different medications. His wife brought some medication to pass to him. However, they didn't allow that.
Yeah.
And just to round off the details we know about the current information on torture, because we also have, you know, information from 2016 that when they were first arrested, the IRPT leadership in late 2015, until the trial, there was a lot of torture. And we learned from one of the lawyers in the case, Jamshed Yorov, who essentially smuggled out some footage from the detention center that confirmed the torture. We know about that. We also know, though, in this most recent case, that during the prison visit that he had with his wife, which has already been mentioned, on March 9th, Hayit showed injuries on his forehead and on his stomach, which he said were caused by beatings from officials. And as Salim John already said, the reason was that he was refusing to participate in what we now know is a very widespread pattern of forcing these prisoners to record videos, denouncing other peaceful opposition figures. And Hayit has, as everyone has already alluded to, he has a reputation for being a man of principle. And he just, you know, refused, as I'm assuming, to participate in this and was just savagely beaten for doing so. And he had told, he'd said to his wife, look, I've been enduring this torture for years and years now, and there was a period of time where I thought that if I didn't really complain, you know, maybe it would get better, but now I realize that it's not going to get better and I could really die here. So I'm telling you, I'm instructing you, please go out, tell the international community, because if they don't get me some help, I really may die. And so it sort of reached this critical point. And we know Khomeini Rose mentioning some other political prisoners, you know, we have had ways of contacting their family members, and we're hearing that a number of them have been put up to recording these videos. And Hayit and I think one other prisoner have been separated. I think Saeed Omar Husseini. I think the two of them had been separated from the other leaders and put in another CISO, another detention center, because of their political importance. So there's a lot of methods being used here to sort of psychologically and physically humiliate these people.
So our only window to his situation is his wife now, right? Is there any other sources that we have?
Well, you know, sometimes, as Salim Jones said, there are some sources in the prison sometimes speak, and there's sometimes we hear from family members that are able to periodically communicate with their family members in prison, and so some of that information trickles out.
How much access the family members have to him? I mean, can they go and see whenever they want, or there's a kind of a limitation to that? How does it work?
No, they can come and see him or other political prisoners once in a half a year, I think.
Yeah, one in 6 months.
Sometimes it even happens that they deny this and people are waiting next round.
Wow. There's one other thing about Haiti that I want to mention also, is that in 2013, when Human Rights Watch was on the ground, we met with him, and I remember this was on the eve, if you remember, the eve of the 40th anniversary of the founding of this political party, the IRPT, and Haiti was responsible for inviting foreign guests, and this was supposed to be a big event, and the government in that week decided to revoke issuing visas in the airport to foreigners. And when we interviewed Haiti about this upcoming event, this is before the party was declared a terrorist organization, it was before this terrible 2015 crackdown, he said to me, something bad is going to happen. I know something terrible is going to happen. I feel like I'm under surveillance. And indeed, later that very day, I got a message that he was beaten by unknown assailants, people in sort of, you know, sports clothing, who just beat him up. And we were able to then visit with him in the hospital the next day in April 2013. And so he's really, this is a man who's been through a lot of abuse over the years and somehow has always managed to maintain his principles.
Yeah, it's such a difficult conversation. And of course, it's beyond imagination on how his family is coping with this. Let's talk about that aspect. And also, what has been done to help him? Is there anything anyone can do to help him? Is there any hope that he will ever be out of jail? So I will get back to all these questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast. I'm joined by Homira Bakhtiyor, independent Tajik journalist and activist, Steve Severlu, Human Rights Watch's Central Asia researcher, Salim John Ayubov, acting director of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Tajik service, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the fate of Muhammad Ali Hayat, the deputy chairman of Banned Islamic Revival Party of Tajikistan, who's serving life term prison in Tajikistan. Okay, about the family. Did any of you have recently met and spoke to his family, any of his family members?
I was able to meet Hayat's wife a few years ago in Tajikistan, and I've also met his son, who's outside the country, luckily. You know, this is really a tale of fathers and sons. You know, there are a number of IRPT people in prison, and all their families are really suffering and spread across the world and have been hunted. And some forced to flee to Europe, some hiding out in other places. But yes, Hayat's wife is also a really courageous person. Yeah. And I think one of the things that we're hoping will come out of her act of bravery these past few weeks is that the diplomatic representatives in Dushanbe, we think, should be meeting with her and offering her as much support as possible, and showing the government that really there should be no stigma attached to people that were part of a legitimate, moderate, democratically oriented political party. There really should be these discussions of terrorism and extremism. The government may want to fool the public with this narrative, but it's not going to work. And I think in order for that to happen, diplomats need to meet with the family members of these imprisoned IRPT leaders and send that message that there's nothing wrong with this community, that we support human rights and political dialogue.
Yeah, you mentioned the stigma, and that's very important to talk about. I mean, Hayat being declared by the authorities as an enemy of the state or enemy of the nation, it brings an extra challenge to already a challenging situation there. So what are their stories of day-to-day survival of the family members who are still in Tajikistan? How they survive? How their day-to-day life looks like?
According to some information, I don't know if it's proper to talk about that. I heard that the Islamic Revival Party and former friends of Hayat somehow helping his family. Maybe not enough, but somehow. I think most important thing here, maybe it's a psychological assistance to his family and to himself somehow. Because I remembering the 1990s, the early years of the democracy in Tajikistan. Now, if you say democracy in Tajikistan, it sounds like, you know. So all those people and somehow me also have been in a big euphoria that finally the communist regime done, so the new life is starting. So, and as the other people in the civilized world leaving, and there was a lot of hopes about Western help. However, I'm thinking why Muhammad Ali didn't stay, for example, in Rastokhiz or in Democratic Party or in other groups, let's say secular groups.
Yeah.
I think not only him, but many others joined the Islamic Party because it was really the force that could make a difference in Tajikistan. Not bringing the Islamic system, but just bringing democracy, bringing human rights. So, and I think now, today, all we are who are in the West and all the Western countries, Western organizations should think about it, that somehow those kind of peoples are victims of those ideas. I remember another guy who then left Tajikistan and lived in Norway, and he himself and his family became radicalized, and his son was killed in Afghanistan. And this guy was the first Tajik who received an international human rights prize. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, today maybe the best way is to ask Western countries to put more pressure on the Tajik government to allow at least the Red Cross organization or independent NGOs to visit Mr. Hayat.
Yeah.
To visit Mr. Saifullah Zoda and Husseini and others, and not only those are from Islamic Party, but many others.
Yeah.
We know sometimes in just 15 minutes, 20 people has got a long-term serve just being accused as members of the Hizb ut-Tahrir, for example.
Yeah.
And we know that half of them have never heard about this this organization or party or something like this.
Yeah.
So the best way and the easiest way to help them, it's as a first step, is to ask the Tajik government to open the gates of the prisons to the representatives of the Red Cross, of the OSCE, of the... I know sometimes the UN reporter could have the privilege to visit those prisons.
Yeah.
For example, last year he visited Kurgan Tube prison, and there was one prisoner told the real situation. And then the reporter left the country, and this prison have been beaten many times for doing this. So we have this information. And so it shouldn't be just visiting.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be constant access to those people. And then the whole information will be on the table, and we will see the real and big picture.
Yeah. So, Bruce, you have been we were so much laser focus on Mr. Hayat. So let's go into some of the solution-oriented stuff here. So Mr. Hayat is in jail, Bruce, and his health is bad and deteriorating, and family members who are in Tajikistan are struggling. So what's the best thing can be done about this now, at this stage?
You know, that's kind of a tough question, because the Human Rights Organization has already called for his immediate release,
yeah,
you know, almost a year ago. And in fact, the UN followed up a few months later and said they were surprised that there was no reaction on the part of Tajik officials to the request for information on him and the, you know, the demand that he be freed right away. So the Tajik authorities have been totally non-responsive when it comes to his case. It, And this is interesting because at the same time, the Tajik government is trying to get massive loans from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And you know, I know that the financial organizations don't like to cross over with political issues, but this is really one of those cases where I think the UN, you know, should be speaking with these organizations and saying, you know, we understand they need the money and we understand there's a good purpose for it. But the Tajik government has been behaving irresponsibly and has been non, you know, out of communication with us on important issues like this. And some of this aid that they want has to be conditioned on them allowing some of the things that we're demanding. You know, at the least, as Salim John suggested, there should be people that have access to these prisons on a regular basis. Of course, it would be obviously the best case scenario would be that they would actually release him immediately, as the UN called upon them to do. But certainly, like I said, if the Tajik government, on the one hand, wants help, financial help from Western organizations, then they're going to have to listen to some of these Western organizations' demands for greater access and more accountability when it comes to the judiciary in Tajikistan and the people who are currently being held in Tajik prisons.
Yeah, that makes sense. But the authorities are, you know, it's hard to understand what they do and why they do. Like, you know, recently there were some cases like Godoyev was let go. And then you had a journalist being released, Mir Saidov, I believe his name was. And then the kids of IRPT members were let go. You know, after all this, it was kind of disappointing to see they just put another political prisoners in jail, Naim John, for 15 years. It's just very hard to understand the logic, the way they are acting. So also talking about these the other cases, you know, there has been some success stories, at least on behalf of activists and NGOs, that because of their pressure, you had some success stories, these kids coming out and a journalist was released. Is there anything to build on that to try to pressure Tajik authorities to do some good about cases like Mr. Haitov?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that is what gives us some hope, is these few successes that you just referenced, Muhammad, of two children being allowed to leave the country, Hairul Omer Saidov, the journalist, after a sort of 9-month social media campaign, ended up not getting that 12-year sentence that we were so afraid the journalist was going to get. And, you know, and then, of course, we saw a fair amount of pushback, I think, also on the government's narrative about the Dangara terrorist attack last summer. And so I see, in a way, one hopes is that this really incredibly dark period that Tajikistan is going through will not last nearly as long as the one we saw in the country where I'm currently located, Uzbekistan, which it took so long to get to a point where we started to see releases. And I think that's one, you know, point that Bruce made perfectly about tying it to economic investment and aid. That absolutely has to be done. We estimate the most conservative number of political prisoners might be 150. It's probably closer to something like 300 political prisoners in Tajikistan. Humayro may have some additional estimates to offer on that, but that is such a huge number. We also have the International Red Cross unable to visit prison facilities, and so that's why in this recent press release that we wrote on the Haidt case, you know, I think we sort of lowered our expectations because the situation is so bad that we said, okay, given that's the situation, we're calling on the diplomats themselves, who don't usually do this, but sometimes they do. We're calling on the diplomats to please seek access to visit Haidt and other prisoners. That's all we have left, essentially. And we're calling on the EU mission, the US embassy, the German embassy, to go ahead and do that. And we think that the Tajik government will, I think, respond if they feel that there's some pressure.
Can I add here?
Sure.
I just wanted to add that about what we can do or what's going in Tajikistan's prisoners. We know that Tajikistan prisoners are more close every time. There is no any possibility in even Red Cross since 2004, they cannot visit Tajik prisons. So in this case, I am agreeing with Steve that the Western diplomats or European diplomats who are right now based in Tajikistan and working there, they can change something. I talked to some NGOs who basically works in Tajikistan, like a local NGOs in Tajikistan, and many of them are like openly say that we are afraid to be in touch with them. Officially, they are afraid, and they said even when we are doing something, we are our partners outside, we are doing it to secrecy. they should not give our name because we don't want to have any problems inside. We want to continue our work here. This is the first problem. The second one is also I was in touch with some of persons who like periodically in Tajikistan trying the like the visits or to take some part in some events of Western and European diplomats events. And even they say that last maybe months, Western and European diplomats are more like a bit calm. They are not so interesting to learn about really situation because we know that the really situation of country you can learn from social media or, I don't know, mass media. But in Tajikistan, we don't have the both of them. Social media people are trying to be more correct in the mass media. Unfortunately, we don't have anyone who can write openly. So they also, the first step, I think, maybe it is better when the human rights organization outside, who is like a foreigners human rights organization, they can be in touch with diplomats in Tajikistan, and they should a bit push them that they should go to this family and talk to them. Because I understand that when people are trying to avoid these families are really are alone. Many people are trying to be far from them, but there is no any reason for foreign Western diplomats who is working there for human rights or democracy or freedom of speech. They can go and visit them. If embassies and office of European or Western organization in Tajikistan, they will openly and ceremony meet with this family, I think that it can give the very hard signal to government, and they then maybe will be some changes.
Yeah, let me build on what you said. And also, Bruce, again, coming back to some of the points that you raised about the situation that Tajikistan is in these days in terms of the help that they need from outside world, especially from the financial world. And given that, I wonder, how can the authorities act in such an impunity? I wonder where they get this courage. Obviously, they should know, someone should know in the position of authority that all these actions will have a reaction, right?
This is strange because they're actually, the Tajik government is one of the biggest beneficiaries of the World Campaign Against Terrorism that I can possibly imagine. They get all the security help they can possibly use from China, from Russia, from the West, you know. And every time that they appear to be, you know, when they have the government implements a crackdown or Tajik authorities are accused of some wrongdoing or something like that, sooner or later they work into their conversation that they have security problems, there's a security threat, they could go down, you know, and no one wants to see another Afghanistan that creeps into the CIS. And you know, that these Western governments and more generally world governments have played into this for so long that the Tajik authorities, I think they have this understanding that while they might have to endure some criticism, no one is going to cut them loose entirely, because there no one is really sure that might not happen. And Steve raised the Dangora attack last year, you know, and this is just classic for the Tajik government, you know, that they make use of this. This was a horrible tragedy, and instead the Tajik government turned it to its own purposes, first by blaming the IRPT for being the ones behind the attack, but then more broadly by trying to portray themselves as being under threat, and no one wanted that, you know. So they've been playing the same card again and again and again successfully, and they know that it will work. You know, again, with as far as the financial organizations, yes, you know, I'd mentioned that, but again, I had also mentioned in that same statement that, you know, they don't want to be tied to politics. A lot of these groups, the World Bank, the IMF, Asian Development Bank, people like that, they don't want their loans, their grants, their projects to be tied to the geopolitical world at all. And they will make the argument that it's the people ultimately that benefit from this, although there are questions about how much of all the money they give actually goes to the people or to the projects that they're supporting. But, you know, like I said, after the Tajik government, Rahman's been in power since 1992. He's heard the criticism and he's seen the results when they endure it and then just start saying, you know, we're under threat. And if we don't get help, who knows what will happen here and who knows how far it'll spread past Tajikistan.
Sure. Selim John, from whatever aspect you look into the situation in Tajikistan, it looks so bad. Looking into this from the Tajik authorities' point of view, from their thinking, why they do what they do, I'm just curious as to, let's talk about the IRPT situation, for example. You know, this party is not anymore in a situation that can directly challenge the authorities in any way. But then why they keep coming after them? I mean, what is their motivation? What are they driven by in doing so?
I think probably why they are continuing the same policy depends on that. Probably not all the political goals reached so far. That's number one. Number two, they are getting power from the people.
They are mean authorities.
From the people's fear, let's say. However, it's not a fear. It's kind of a civil war syndrome, you know. A biggest part of the society who went through this tragedy will never again want to demand anything that or to gather in the center of the city for the meeting, for the demonstration, just to ask their own rights, because they saw everything before their eyes, you know. And the government also using and abusing this experience of the people, you know. Before very soon there will be June 27, the day when the peace agreement was signed by the government and by the party about what we are talking now, and which is in this kind of situation, and which was the driving force of the opposition at the time. So a week or 2 weeks before the celebration, so they will start telling about the history, how it happened, and we will show all kind of graphic images, videos, films, how it was. So, of course, it works, and people don't want to go to the same place again. So this is number two. And number three is I support fully what Bruce said about the financial aid. However, we have a lot of civil society organizations who are also receiving grants from abroad. However, we haven't seen their real reaction. They're doing something. They're doing something, but they have a kind of self-censorship, not to make the government, the authorities unhappy, to keep those NGOs alive and things like this. So I am not blaming them. I'm just telling that there is a lot of reasons why the government is feeling itself comfortable in this kind of situation and continues the same policies without thinking that where they will come by the end of the day.
Oh, yeah. It's a tough discussion. I think we also need to end it. Oh, we are way over time. Okay, let's do this, Steve, with you. You know, a situation is really already so bad, but how bad can it get?
How bad can it get?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't usually get that question. I mean, it can only get worse. Authoritarian systems are inherently paranoid. Yeah. You're asking, you know, why are they doing this? Why are they acting against their own best interests? And I think that's just the nature of authoritarianism, which in Tajikistan these days is inching ever closer to totalitarianism. You know, there's been just a lot of alarm signals going off and, you know, increasing irrationality, as I think Bruce said. It can get much worse. I think, you know, of course, people like to, especially in D.C. circles and other places, they like to link the security situation and this, you know, the catastrophe that could ensue of, you know, a dysfunctional state like Tajikistan could really become much, much more unstable if these policies persist. And, you know, as human rights advocates, we sometimes greet those assessments with a little skepticism, and it can be a little alarmist. But, you know, I think at their core, those assessments are correct, which is that without some system for the rule of law and human rights, some safety valves, let's say, for the expression of dissent, which many would argue the IRPT offered religious Muslims inside Tajikistan, without those outlets, Tajikistan really does, I think, become much less stable, and the situation could really get out of hand. But on the other hand, leaving aside those sort of security arguments, just on a moral standpoint, the situation is bad enough that it requires much more attention than it's getting. So that's why Human Rights Watch was in the European Union the last few days. We were in Brussels raising these issues, and we do that in Washington and Berlin and everywhere we can that they'll listen. We have seen that places like Azerbaijan and Russia sometimes get a little bit more attention, maybe because of the war in Ukraine, or maybe because, you know, Azerbaijani campaigners were really creative in the way they linked up with you know, bands like U2 to raise the case of the political prisoners there. So I think that's what Tajikistan needs a little bit more of, which is, you know, some creative thinking, some deeper media attention. And I think the nature of the aid dependency of the government makes it inherently more likely to bend to some of that pressure. So I would say we just need to put our heads down and we need to come up with a little bit more of an effective strategy.
Yeah, at least in the Godayev's case, I mean, he was referring to German embassies there, saying without their help, he wouldn't be out. It's a kind of a positive development in that sense. Well, thank you very much, Steve Severlo, Human Rights Watch Central Asia researcher, for your insightful comments today. And also, big thanks goes to Homira Bakhtiyor, independent Tajik journalist, Salim John Ayubov, acting director of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Tajik service, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. Thank you, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week. Bye-bye.